The American West is a desert. Is that desert shifting east? I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner. This is ClimateCast. It's called the 100th Meridian. That longitudinal line runs from Texas through Oklahoma, Kansas, Nebraska, and into the Dakotas. Climate experts designate this invisible line as the boundary line between the arid West and the more humid East. A new study suggests climate change is expanding the desert eastward. Richard Seeger is a professor with Columbia University. I talked with him via Skype.
It genuinely is a boundary between the humid eastern part of the United States and the more arid western parts. And it's actually quite a sharp boundary. It is close to the 100th meridian. It might actually be more closer to the 98th meridian, but the 100th meridian obviously sounds better, and that's probably why it's ended up passing into popular conception. It arises from a whole series of activities in the atmosphere. In the winter, the western plains are blocked from moisture by the Rocky Mountains, while storm systems manage to bring Atlantic moisture into the eastern part of the plains. And then in the summer as well, we have a situation where humidity coming around the Bermuda High brings moisture into the eastern plains, but the western plains tend to get dry, hot air coming up from the desert southwest. So throughout the year, the atmosphere is working to create this aridity gradient. And it's very well reflected in the moisture in the soils, the natural vegetation, and also in how the land is used for agricultural purposes, and even all the way up to the density of human settlement. So it's not just a physical climate border, but it's become a border in how the land is used and how people are populated across the continent.
And I notice you can literally see on maps how road grids and town density changes either side of this 100th meridian. How does psychogeography affect decisions like where people decide to live?
Well, when we did this study, we were curious as to whether this this population divide that occurs at the 100th meridian was and how agriculture has developed was related to a conception of the land. And whether that has sort of transitioned into laws which made it and customs that made it different to made development methods different to the West and to the East. But we found that wasn't really the case. The reason the settlement patterns and agricultural use are different to the West to the East is really because the environment is very different. So although there was many efforts in the 19th century and the early 20th century to develop the West, much like the East, and Western politicians didn't like talk of the limits of the land in the West, nature forced back against that. And what eventually, after many false starts, what eventually ended up happening in terms of how the land is used was very reflective of the changing aridity as you go from the east to the west.
So what did this paper in the journal Earth Interactions find about this dry to wetter boundary shifting as climate changes?
Right. So what we found is that over the recent decades, and we have good data for this going back to the 1970s, the boundary has shifted from the west to the east, and there's been a general increase in aridity across the plains, so that wherever any given level of aridity used to be in the 1970s or 1980s, we're now finding it a degree or so further to the east now. So it's a move of sort of 100, 150 miles or something. And to a large extent, that's just due to rising temperatures, which increase the amount of moisture the atmosphere can take from the land surface. But it's also contributed to a decline in precipitation in the southwestern parts of the United States that's also influences the southwestern plains. So there's two processes going on. And then looking into the future, where, of course, we have to use climate model projections, we see that this westward encroachment of the aridity continues over the coming decades.
Really? So that's interesting to us in Minnesota. We're kind of an interesting case study. Our annual precipitation data here shows the eastern part of our state is actually getting wetter with more than 30 inches of precipitation annually. But western Minnesota, the border lies very close to that 98th meridian you talked about. And annual precipitation there seems to have stayed right around 20 inches. What might we expect as we model this out going forward for places like Minnesota?
Right. It sounds like what you're talking about is what you would expect to continue in the future. You're right that precipitation will tend to, models project that precipitation will tend to increase in the northeastern and midwest part of the United States, but decrease in the southwest. So it's kind of got that southwest to northeast gradient. But temperatures will rise absolutely everywhere, and that is a key component in the land hydrology and tends to increase aridity everywhere. So overall, and including up in your northern part of the plains, you expect the western part to aridify and lines of equal aridity to be moving west eastward as the years and decades go by.
We know that as you move farther south in the United States, obviously with the higher sun angles in summer, we can get more evaporation. What about impacts in other areas of the U.S.? There's a lot of ranching, going on, Oklahoma, parts of Texas. What do you see in the southern parts of the United States?
Well, as the aridity gradient gets reflected in agriculture, you find that most of the wheat that is grown and land being used as rangeland is to the west of the 100th meridian, and the corn production is to the east of the 100th meridian, with the exception of where you can irrigate, like in Nebraska. Obviously, that agricultural use has grown about to reflect the environmental conditions that farmers found. So you would expect that as aridity increases, that the corn production, which is more in the central plains to the north, would become increasingly restricted to the east, and the land would become more suitable for crops that can tolerate hotter, drier conditions like wheat, or become more suitable for rangelands. But of course, there's a real restriction there in the how high the temperatures can be for animals to tolerate them before there's a decline in productivity. So we're pretty sure that just as agriculture has adapted to climate over the past century and a half, it will have to continue to adapt to climate as aridity levels increase in the future.
Richard, sometimes it's hard for people to see how even these small climate shifts can have outsized impacts. What happens when climate shifts even a little bit in a sensitive climate zone?
Well, I think that we do see these changes in the past. We've looked at when you see the big droughts that have occurred in the plains over the past century, of course, the Dust Bowl drought in the 1930s and so on. So the whole region of the plains is very sensitive to climate. It's a continual battle between more arid and more humid conditions on a year-to-year basis. And year-to-year and decade-to-decade, we see the impacts of these droughts. So I think as time goes on and we're adding on to that natural variability, a general progression towards more arid conditions, I think we'll see just more of these impacts and finding new impacts cropping up in areas that we didn't expect to see them before.
Richard Seeger, professor at Columbia University, thanks for being on ClimateCast today.
You're very welcome.
My name is Caitlin Dory, and I'm a 14-year-old student from Grand Rapids, Minnesota, and I organized a climate convening to educate my community about climate change and what's going on. I go to a project-based school, so I needed a project to do to get credit. This group called Climate Generation had been presenting their Youth Convening Minnesota program, so I ended up getting in contact with these Youth Convening Minnesota people, and they spent the next 7 months leading me through setting up the convening. It's not something you like to think about just every day, but as they're explaining to me what this issue is and what we can do about it, I kind of like the idea of actually doing something and getting involved. I basically gathered as many people as possible. I think about 50 people were in attendance to the Eagles Club, which is a bar down in Grand Rapids. I got speakers to come in and explain what the issue is, how it affects everybody at home, and then I had breakout sessions where we got to teach people what they can do at home about it. It was really cool to see how involved everyone was getting. These were obviously people that cared very much about the climate and wanted to do something about it. And, you know, I did have people coming up to me afterwards congratulating me. And they all had their own stories, things they were doing themselves, or just they happened to kind of stumble in and they were really interested in learning about it, which was cool to see. I mean, it's our home. We're all going to live here. We're going to spend our entire lives here. So if we're ruining that, we're ruining it for ourselves and for our children and for everybody there. It is a scary thing, and sometimes it can look daunting, like there's nothing you can do about it, but I am hopeful because I think there are enough people that are working very hard to help solve this issue, and I have no doubt that the steps are going to be made to at least slow down what's happening. There's no reason not to be hopeful.
One of the most unusual and newsworthy climate events this summer was the record heat and massive wildfires in the Scandinavian Arctic. CARE 11 meteorologist Sven Sundgaard visited that region last month, and I asked him for some perspective on the changes he saw there.
Well, the focus of my trip really was to go to Svalbard. So obviously, with my name, I have family in Norway. So I made a quick 3-day visit to visit relatives really quick. But I had never been in the high Norwegian Arctic. You know, Norway's a little unique in that you have the Gulf Stream and all those influences, so that places in mainland Norway that are above the Arctic Circle are much milder and greener than the rest of the Arctic. But Svalbard is way up there and kind of off the beaten path. And I always wanted to get there and just see, you know, kind of firsthand what's going on there, because it's really the front lines of climate change. We hear about how dramatic the changes are in the Arctic, but it's even more so in that area.
Well, and we know that there's been some pretty intense impacts there this summer, the record heat, the wildfires. Yeah. What kind of impacts did you see there?
Well, the thing that I found amazing is the Norwegians, they're kind of like Minnesotans. They love to complain about the weather. And they kept talking about how hot it was. And, you know, normally I'm like, okay, to a Norwegian, what does that mean? It hit 80 twice?
Right.
But no, they have had a string of 90s, which is unheard of in Oslo. That would be the equivalent of us hitting 100 multiple times in the summer. You know, we do that maybe once every few years on average. So this is equivalent almost of like a Dust Bowl kind of year, like a 1936 year for Minnesota is basically what Norway just got done having.
And the wildfires there, I assume there was talk of that as well?
Yeah, and I think those are mostly confined to the Swedish Arctic, more so than Norway. But to be talking wildfires in the Arctic is a little bit bizarre. And that's, as you know, is a pretty moist part of the world, even in a kind of a dry period, because you just have every storm system running into Scandinavia. It's like the Pacific Northwest.
Sure.
You know that when it's dry there and you have fires, that there's a real problem.
Longer-term changes, ice changes. Did you see any of that? And did you talk to anybody there about those long-term changes?
Yes. Yeah, so in Svalbard, they have the fastest-moving glaciers on the planet. And a lot of that is because the melting and the warming there is so rapid. And you would look at this massive glacier and you're like, wow. You know, anytime you see a glacier, no matter where it is in the world, they're pretty intimidating.
Yes.
They're huge.
Sure.
And they're calving into the ocean. And then, you know, your guide or somebody would say, now look over there. And he'd point out the glacial moraines, where the glaciers were just about a generation ago. And your jaw dropped. I mean, we were in whole valleys. They would take the boat into an entire valley that 20, 30 years ago was completely encased in ice.
Wow.
You know, many meters high all the way back into the mountain. And it's a fraction of its former self just in 25, 30 years.
That's amazing. And you talked to some folks there. Let's hear some sound about the changes that they're seeing in that area.
So I just by chance one day I was on a boat and saw, you know, the Norwegian Polar Institute emblem on this guy's coat. And I'm like, did you buy that somewhere? And he's like, no, my name is Kim Holm and I'm the international director of the Norwegian Polar Institute. So he's basically in charge of kind of collaborating the international research. You go to Ny Ålesund, which is the farthest north settlement on the planet, and it's basically just a research town.
The world oceans are becoming warmer. and the ice around the archipelago is vanishing, and the open water then leads to more heat transfer from the ocean to the atmosphere, which maintains the warm wintertime air temperature in this area. Well, from the cores that are 1,400 years old, at least the northern part of Svalbard has never been as warm as now. But the rate of change and the levels of change are such that the Arctic will not be the Arctic that we know.
You heard him talk about there, what part of what makes Svalbard so unique. It's a milder part of the Arctic normally, even though we're talking 78 to 80 degrees latitude.
Wow.
Because the Gulf Stream literally ends there.
Sure.
If you look in a map. But that's also what's allowing it to warm up even faster. You know, we talk about the Arctic's warming at twice the rate of the rest of the planet. Well, Svalbard, it's four times the rate, because literally the oceans, the heat that's building up on the planet is being transported like a conveyor belt to Svalbard. So that's breaking up the ice. I know you talk about it all the time. And when we're referring to the Arctic, we talk a lot about feedback loops. You get rid of the ice, and that only helps the warming more rapidly. It releases methane and carbon that's stored in the ground. But it also, you know, in Minnesota, we forget that the reason the lake freezes over is that keeps the lake warm from freezing otherwise solid.
Right.
So that it, you know, a whole nother life can exist while we're 30 below zero. Well, when you have that ice off, all that heat just keeps flowing back, and that's only contributing to a shorter sea ice season and warming up Svalbard. They're getting rain events in the winter, and they're talking about how that impacts the reindeer, because it is still, like Minnesota, you're still going to get winter.
Sure.
And that rain freezes, and you know, reindeer barely can eke out an existence there. They're brushing their nose through the snow, mm-hmm. and they don't get that much snow, but what they do get blows around and is kind of powdery, so they can move it around to get to the grass. Well, with ice, there's no way, and reindeer herds are starving to death. And it, like I said, the average reindeer lives 9 years because they grind their teeth away by getting moss and lichen off of the rocks. So
yeah.
They basically starve to death by 9 years. So it's already a rough existence.
Yeah, it's tough.
We're
to
just
be
adding things in there that they have not adapted to.
You know, Svalbard, isn't that where they have that huge seed vault?
Yeah.
And didn't it, part of it flood recently? And that's supposed to be one of the most stable areas on the planet. Were you able to see that or talk to folks about
it? Yeah, I did. You're not allowed to go in. It's this very high security place. And right now, we were kind of disappointed because it's known for this beautiful facade, especially in the winter months, in 24 hours of night that they have, that's all kind of blue. It's supposed to look like northern lights, but it was all covered in scaffolding because it's under construction, because in 2016 they did have flooding. And yeah, it's supposed to be a place that, A, is about as far away from conflict as you can get,
mm-hmm.
but also deep into the permafrosts to preserve the seeds. It's designed so that if there's an all-out catastrophe on the planet, nothing in that vault will get above freezing for, I think, 10 years or something. But yeah, they had some record rainfall, again, winter rainfall, and some flooding. And now they're having to adapt, like a lot of us, to a changing climate. And how can they make that seed vault still secure?
You talk about the changes there. People obviously are witnessing that happen in our own lifetimes. What's the level of awareness for climate change in Norway?
Well, the Norwegians are kind of on the leading edge of this. You know, Americans are kind of being dragged kicking and screaming, and it seems like we go three steps forward and then a step back. Mm. Norway's pumping a lot of money into this. They're the ones who solely funded, I think, the seed vault, and are putting another billion into it to make sure that it's structurally sound, and collaborating with the world, really, on climate research. You know, there's only so many countries, the U.S., Russia, and Norway being some of them, that have a stake in the Arctic. And Norway really looks to the future to try. And they're in a position where they can. It's an affluent country.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a little guilt because they've made a lot of money off of North Sea oil. A
little Scandinavian guilt,
yeah,
too, thrown
but
in there.
Yeah, a little Lutheran guilt or something.
Right.
But they're investing in the future. And they know that this is a major issue. And they know that they have a stake in that.
What can Minnesotans take away from the changes that you saw in the Scandinavian Arctic?
I think it's, you know, as a meteorologist, we study this stuff all winter long. I'm looking, ever since I went to Churchill a few years ago, really keep a close eye on sea ice because it's very important to polar bears. Svalbard has more polar bears than people. There's 3,000 of them. We didn't see any, though, but but just the dramatic change there. You can look at a chart, you can look at the data, but to be there and see literally see just how much it's changed. And to talk to people there, you know, Svalbard made the news in February when it was above freezing in the depths yeah. of the Arctic winter. And it's partly that heat transport from the Gulf Stream. So it's sobering in that the change is so rapid that it will not be the Svalbard we know. There's no going back, but there's still a lot of the rest of the Arctic and Svalbard too that we can mitigate some of that change, but we really do have to act now. I think the urgency is the biggest thing to take away from. There's the debate about, oh, what do we do? How much do we do by this year? Mm-hmm. That's done. We need to really move on.
Arctic amplification, that's a weather geek term for what we talk about when we talk about a warming Arctic and a slower and wavier jet stream pattern. Where we live, you know, Sven, you and I have both been at this for a while. Have you noticed changes on the daily weather maps in the last 10 or 20 years?
Yeah, I think this year was a great example of it. And I'm not going to say glad, but I am almost glad that we had the May we did after the April we did, because it really visualized that, because there's so many people in April. Oh, so much for global warming,
right?
You know, because people cannot step outside of their own bubble. And this winter and spring was really, I think, one of the most vivid examples of that jet stream pattern we're talking about here that I've seen. But it's been more and more like that in a lot of these years. You know, at the same time, the reason the North Pole was so warm, it was when the East Coast was getting all those crazy storms and cold, and then we were warm. So it was, you know, you have these waves, you can picture it, just these waves, but these extreme waves that we shouldn't be having. And it's allowing heat to go way further north than it should, but also we're getting the bad end of the stick occasionally with some of that extreme cold. But I think Minnesotans forgot that, you know, we thought it was such a cold winter, but really it was just a little bit below. February was legitimately cold, but we made up for what? In mid-July, I think we surpassed the point where we're warmer than normal for the year, despite the April and February we had, which was pretty dramatic.
I keep coming back to the jacket and the patch. We got to get one of those. That's really cool, right? What was the name of that organization again?
The Norwegian Polar Institute.
Oh, yeah, that's got to be a
great jacket. Or Norse Polar Institute, they say.
Perfect. Sven Sundgaard, meteorologist with Care 11 Sunrise, thanks for sharing your Arctic experience with ClimateCast today.
Absolutely, and there's going to be more this fall. I'm doing some segments. I bring cameras with me now when I travel, and there's going to be more on that. Follow me on social media, and I'm posting a lot more. So
you're going to run some pieces this fall?
Yeah, I don't know exactly when, but it will be this fall sometime, probably October, November. It's a real important issue to me. That's part of why I wanted to go there for the last few years, is to literally see the changes that are happening.
Well, it's great that you work for a media outlet that supports that kind of work, because as we know, not everyone does.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sven Sundgaard from Care 11, thanks so much.
You bet. Thank you.
That's ClimateCast this week. With thanks to Climate Generation, I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner.